always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life. Hello and welcome to today's Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem, and today I want to spend a little time talking about an issue that is, well, it seems like there's always something on the front page or in the news about it, although maybe not the story behind the story. You heard the Breakpoint today with Chuck Colson. You heard him talking about crime and the fact that despite the suggestion by the liberal perspective that the crime has gone down even in the midst of recession, because it actually doesn't have a lot to do with the economy. And looking at the, by the way, you can hear Breakpoint again this afternoon about 4:30. I was looking at front page of USA Today, had an article about Clarence Thomas and about his conservative positions on crime and criminal defense. And we do want to talk a little bit about what's going on in crime. Of course, not long ago, California judge decided that thousands of prisoners would be released because of overcrowding and issues there. There's a new book out that represents some important study on the whole area of the criminal justice system. It's called More God, Less Crime. The subtitle is Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And we're looking forward to having with us to talk about his research and his work, Byron Johnson. Professor Johnson is Distinguished Professor of the Social Sciences at Baylor University, and he directs the Institute for Studies of Religion, as well as the program on pro-social behavior at Baylor. And he is with us on the line today, and looking forward to getting into that discussion. Professor Johnson, thanks so much for joining with us today. We're glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Neil. It's good to be with you today.
The book is just out. It's published by Templeton Press. And in it, you begin with a story. And I guess I'd like, before we talk about the criminal justice system, to tell a little bit about the story. Because in the preface, or I guess the first chapter, you talk about experiencing religious prejudice at the university level. And that kind of is sort of the premise of the book, is that the role and impact of faith in the criminal justice system is underreported or ignored or biased against. But in fact, you experienced that bias firsthand, and we hear about that from time to time. But tell us a little bit about your experience in the university system.
Well, you know, this goes back to 1990 when I was a young assistant professor, and I was a person of faith, deep faith. And I didn't mind people knowing about that, and felt, in fact, I felt it was important for people to know just exactly where I was coming from. And you know, the university where I was teaching, Memphis State at that time, it's now called the University of Memphis. I was a very popular professor. I had high evaluations from students, and you know, I was doing the kinds of things that professors are expected to do: publish, teach well, and do community service. But I knew I kind of ran against the grain there because I was an outspoken Christian, and I did research on religion. And I had a department chairperson who said to me, you know, this research that you're doing on religion is not going to count toward tenure. I said, well, how can that be? If I'm getting it published in peer-reviewed journals, which is the standard that we measure people by in the academy, what do you mean that won't count? He said, it just won't. And that was my first exposure to the fact that they didn't even want me doing research, or at least the chair didn't, on religion. And I know that because I was outspoken in my faith, that was somewhat of an embarrassment. But I thought, you know, welcome to university life. You have these kinds of things, and, you know, it's not going to be a big deal. But then at the end of my my fourth year there, I got a letter of termination. And it came as a complete surprise, because I was going to be applying for tenure in the fall. And so I remember going in to see the dean about it, and the dean said, you know, look, the reality is I don't have to give you a reason for your termination. You're on probation until such time as you go up for tenure. And he goes, you know, we can just let you go if we don't like the color of your eyes. And so that was the end of the explanation I got. So then I went to the provost of the university, who was a Christian. And I said, you know, what's happening here? And he goes, I feel really bad about this. And I said, well, just reverse the decision. You're the provost, then. It's within your power. And clearly I'm being discriminated against. And the provost, you know, basically said, I really feel like you need to go get a job at a teach at a small Christian college. That's where you would fit in, and you're never going to fit in at a major university or, you know, a secular state university. You're always going to have problems because you run against the grain. And I said, you know, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if I were a Marxist, would we? And he agreed with me. And so it was pretty blatant that I was being discriminated against. And, you know, I wound up leaving, of course, and but my career took off after that. And I've had a very successful career. And just a few years later, after the Memphis fiasco, I wound up directing a major research center at Vanderbilt University. And then after that, I wound up in the Ivy League schools. And so I've had a very successful career. I've brought in a lot of research money that good old Memphis could have had access to if they hadn't chased me off. But I wanted to tell the story. Not because I wanted people necessarily to hear about my past, but I wanted people to know that this discrimination against faith-based programs and people that are motivated out of faith is very real. I've seen it a lot, and it has happened in my own life. And, you know, I think people should be judged on the merits of what they do. And if we have faith-based programs can be effective, then we certainly shouldn't be discriminating against them.
Well, I appreciate you. It's kind of a... it's not really a side note to the story, but it does. It's a whole other story, which we should revisit at some point. And the fact is, you, I'm sure, have heard over the years from many like-minded professors that are facing challenges. In fact, I think one of your recommendations was that, you know, until you get tenure, you really have to kind of guard your research and your thoughts, right?
Well, you know, the scripture says, "Be wise as serpents and gentle as doves." And I really do believe that we should be wise about these things. And, you know, I don't know that I would go back and change what I did in terms of my visibility as a believer on campus. But, you know, I do think we need to be smart about these things, and we do want to get tenure. And there is this hostility within the academy towards faith that's quite shocking. And I've seen it over a 25-year period. It's very real. And I know that when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, which is an Ivy League institution, and we would do a study that showed that, you know, church attendance reduced crime or delinquency, you know, that made them shudder. It's not the finding that they would have preferred. If I had found that attending church increases the likelihood that you'll commit suicide, that would have been something they would have been very happy for me to have published and to be recognized for.
Well, Byron, is this in the area of crime? Your book's called More God, Less Crime: Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. Just out, is the issue of is it hostility, or is it just sort of underreporting, or just ignoring the reality of faith-based activity within the criminal justice system?
Well, some of it's just plain ignorance. I think some people generally don't know. And I think for a lot of people that are completely secular, there's this fear of the unknown. And faith for them, since they have not been exposed to it, is unknown. And all that they really can go by are the stereotypes that they have of faith and people that are motivated out of faith. So the assumption might be that, you know, these people are uneducated, they're ignorant, they have these ministries that they do, they're misguided, and they're all about evangelism. They don't care about people. They just want to evangelize. And it's these kinds of stereotypes that I think have caused people to diminish the role or to downplay the role of these faith-based organizations. These are nothing but religious do-gooders that want to come into prisons, for example, and do Bible studies. And I think that, unfortunately, these myths really do play out in ways that are unproductive for us, to say the least. And I think one of the things I wanted to do with the book was to use the data to say, here's what, in fact, we do know. And I hope what the book does as a byproduct of that is to help validate for so many people who for years have volunteered their time, talent, and treasure to helping the least, the last, and of these in our midst. And so I hope the book encourages people in that regard, because their efforts have made a difference.
Well, we want to talk a little bit more about that, because you do, in fact, address the fact there are some good-hearted, well-intentioned people that probably are adding to the myths, right?
Yeah.
The motives may not always be right and not really thinking long term. But we'll get to that in a little bit. But tell me about as you did some of the study, maybe some of the bigger picture, the real cost of crime in America. How we look at crime.
Well, Neil, the cost of crime is an interesting thing, and believe it or not, we've not been very sophisticated when we've tried to figure out what crime cost us. So for some people, they might say, well, you have law enforcement officers in a community. So like, let's say they're in your neck of the woods. How many police officers do we have? So what is the law enforcement budget? That's one way we could gauge the cost of crime. And then we have prisons, and we can figure out how much it costs us to incarcerate people. And then we have the courts. But the cost of crime go way beyond that. How do you put the cost of crime on people that are victims of crime? People that have experienced violent crime in their own life have paid a cost, and it's really difficult to monetize what that cost is. What about people who fear crime and they change their behaviors because of the anticipation that they might be the victim of crime? And there are so many different ways to account for the cost of crime. And so economists have been very helpful in recent years to help us cost out what these factors are and what they add up to. And so in the book, one of the things I try to do is to say, what does crime cost America each year? And it's about $1 billion. It's much higher than $1 billion, I think.
It was $300 billion, wasn't it?
It's so much higher than what we've thought it was. And so when you have this enormous cost, and we know now that some of these interventions can play a key role in reducing our costs. Why? Because these are faith-motivated people. They're not asking for funds. They do this out of a calling in their life. So these faith-based programs, many of which are volunteer-driven completely, are not only effective or can be effective, they're so cost-efficient. And I think that we really need to, just if nothing more from the pure economics, give these things some consideration. If you look at California, they've been in the headlines recently because a court order now has forced them to release some 46,000 prisoners because of overcrowding. So there's this panic now across California about 46,000 prisoners coming out at one time, returning to communities all across the state of California. And there's this fear that's a sincere fear, and it's well-placed fear. What do you do about all this? Well, this is where I argue in the book that these communities of faith could really help that whole reentry process by playing a key role.
And we'll take a break here in a moment too. But is the biggest maybe failure issue is it lack of rehabilitation? Is it recidivism? Or is there some other kind of common complaint that keeps our focus in the criminal justice system?
Well, the recidivism rate, and depending on how you measure recidivism, people come up with different figures. But I think it's safe to say that most scholars agree that the recidivism rate is about 66%. So two-thirds of people that come out of prison tend to go back to prison within a three-year window. Now, is that high? It's a high figure. And why is it so high? Well, the reality is if you spend any time in prison, you realize that prisons are about what we call incapacitation. We take people off the streets and we try to keep them busy as we possibly can. We want prisons not to be places that are, breeding grounds for criminal activity and violence. But there's not a whole lot of rehabilitation going on in prisons. They don't have the funding to have a whole lot of rehabilitation programs. There's some. So when these guys come out of prison, what they're facing is this, a difficult road back. They need jobs. They need housing. They need things like transportation, getting a driver's license. They need counseling. And so for many of these guys, the odds are kind of stacked up against them, especially considering that they're moving back into communities that they used to live in and that these are highly disadvantaged communities in the first place, the conditions may be much worse than when they left 4 or 5 years earlier. And so with these odds stacked against them, it shouldn't come as any surprise to us that most of these guys are going to go back and commit another criminal act and wind up back in prison again. And this is why the faith-based programs can be so powerful, is that they not only help inmates transform their lives from the inside out, but these faith-based programs, contrary to the stereotypes that they're all about evangelism, they're about so much more. They're about mentoring. They're about helping these guys get a GED and getting their life back on the right track. And then they're about aftercare. I mean, how can we help these guys once they get out of prison? It's not enough just to do work with them while they're in prison. How can we help them when they get out of prison? That's where the job gets really tough. And so what I argue in the book is that we've made some great strides, and there's so much more that we could possibly do to help these people lead crime-free lives once they get out of prison.
We're talking with Byron Johnson, who's director of the Institute for Studies of Religion. He's also a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University, and he directs their program on pro-social behavior as well. And he's written an important new work called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And in a moment, we'll talk with Professor Johnson a little bit about, you know, how important it is to change the individual or some of the issues of prison culture and how that plays into this as well. And we'd always, as always, welcome your calls to the conversation. It's 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We'll continue in a minute. Two past the hour. Happy to have with us today Byron Johnson, distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University. He directs the Institute for Studies of Religion. He's recognized a leading authority on scientific study of religion, the efficacy of faith-based organizations, domestic violence, and criminal justice. And he's put together interesting research in a new book called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More, and presents a powerful case about where it is actually where faith-based programs are making a difference. And I was interested, Byron, in the book you talked about prison culture, and I was thinking, you know, is it more important that the individual be changed, or is there something about sort of the culture? I mean, so many, mm-hmm. it seems, that are populating our prisons are repeat offenders. So mm-hmm. we've got some cultural, almost some bigger picture issues to deal with.
Boy, you've really hit an important topic. I think a lot of what people see about prisons on television is not helpful to us, because I think they exaggerate certain things. But it is accurate to say this: prison culture is different than the culture that we see on the streets. And when you walk into a prison, there's a code of behavior. And you know, you quickly find out what is acceptable and what's tolerated and what isn't. And this is a culture that the inmates control. There's even a language that you need to learn inside of a prison. So I remember when I first started hanging out in prisons, I'd hear these words. I didn't know what these words meant, but they actually had a whole glossary that I needed to become familiar with just to kind of figure out what people were saying. But this culture in an institution, this is why rehabilitation is so difficult. It's because you don't show weakness, for example. That would not be a good thing. And you mind your own business. You don't snitch on anybody in a prison. That would not be a good thing to do. But let's just say you become a believer. And as a believer, you're taught that you're supposed to be accountable to one another, and that if you see a brother sin, you should go to that brother in love and correct them. Well, that's completely counter to the prison culture. And so what happens for a lot of these guys that turn to God in prison, it's a very tough road to hoe if they're by themselves, but these faith-based programs create an entire faith-based community within a prison, almost a church, if you will. So the prison that I studied in Houston from 1997 to 2002 was a faith-based prison run by Prison Fellowship. It's a state of Texas prison right outside of Houston. half the prison was faith-based and half the prison was just general population inmates. The difference was night and day difference. I mean, you really couldn't believe it. One side, you have inmates arguing over what they're going to watch on television. Is it going to be the Latino inmates wanting to watch soccer and other inmates wanting to watch basketball and the profanity and other kinds of things that you might see that would be deeply troubling on that one side of the general population. Then on the faith-based side, you see inmates worshiping, singing, hugging each other. I remember when I visited this program, I walked in and someone says, "Come hug a thug." And it was kind of like, okay, this is strange. But a completely different environment that was faith-saturated. And so in an environment like that, it's okay to say, you know what, I've made mistakes in my life, and I admit them, and, I have a contrite heart. I want to make amends for what I've done. I want to start a new leaf in life. And if that appears to be weak, so be it. And so what happens in that kind of an environment, you could actually understand how someone could become rehabilitated. And so I argue that religion facilitates the whole process of what we've called rehabilitation for years. And I think this makes some secular people uncomfortable, even though part of it they actually like. And so what I argue is that rehabilitation and spiritual transformation go hand in hand. And so if you're a person of no faith at all, at least don't marginalize the faith factor, because the faith factor may help you achieve the goal that you want, which is rehabilitation and crime reduction. And so this is why I think these faith-based units can be so very powerful in helping an inmate do this. So let's just say you've been to prison four times, but you've always denied you ever did anything wrong. And I've seen inmates do this for years. And it's kind of like you just write off everybody else. The system's crooked. It's bankrupt out there. I didn't do anything wrong. I shouldn't be in prison. But you see someone now that says, you know what? I did do a bunch of bad things in my life. I'm not happy about what I was, but I'm happy about what I've become. And for some of these guys, it's really powerful to be able to kind of rewrite your whole life's narrative, to start over anew and afresh. And that is really powerful. And that's one of the things that I argue in the book is so necessary for these guys, if they're going to be able to make it, to be able to start a clean, new path that allows them to make sense out of the ugliness that was there before.
Just kind of a side note, as I was reading about that, it reminded me that, almost any addictive behavior or any problems that we get into, I mean, that we have kind of the same patterns where we don't show weakness, we isolate,
yeah.
All those things. I mean, as the body of Christ, we do need to be accountable and to be in community with one another.
Right. That's exactly right. And so that's why I think for these groups to exist like this versus having, someone that just goes in and ministers to one person, I think these kinds of faith-based dormitories or faith-based programs have real potential. But in and of themselves, those programs have to be attached to these other things that we were talking about earlier. It's one thing to realize that people have a spiritual component to their life, but they also have these other physical and emotional needs that we need to be, as a church body, attentive to. And so that's why I think the aftercare piece, that's, Neil, the real difficult piece to tackle, because, these communities that these offenders return to are very difficult. They're very problematic. And for a lot of these guys, their situation is so fragile, if they have a really bad day, they know where they can get a hit of cocaine real quick. And if they do that, it's just a tailspin so fast. And the next thing you know, they're back in incarcerated again. So this is very discouraging, and it becomes this vicious cycle. And I think that the church has done so much good, but we could do – that's why I argue the subtitle, We Could Do More.
The book is called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And my guest is Byron Johnson, who is a distinguished professor of social sciences at Baylor University, and he directs the Institute for Studies of Religion and also on Pro-Social Behavior. And we welcome your calls to join the conversation. In a moment, we're going to talk. The book describes several instances where we see this work. We've talked a little bit about the prison in Houston. There are some other examples, and we'll talk about, you know, what people of faith can do, maybe where we can do the most good in this important discussion, and why it's so often overlooked. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. You press 1 to be on the show. We're talking about issues of crime and the faith factor that makes such a big difference in that with Professor Byron Johnson, author of the new book, More God, Less Crime. More in just a couple minutes. Nice to have you along. This is Connecting Faith, and my guest today is Byron Johnson. Professor Johnson is a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University, and he directs their Institute for Studies of Religion. It's an important program. They do a lot of study on religion, faith-based organizations. He's also done some specialties in domestic violence and criminal justice, and written, after a great deal of study, what he's discovered in the criminal justice system, the book called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And the premise is that the role and impact of faith in the system is underreported or undervalued. So, Byron, just tell us, why is it, or I guess maybe how is the impact of religion being undervalued by these experts?
Well, Neil, you know, one of the things that's been disturbing to me over the years is that every time I would do a study, and I've probably done more than anybody in the country, but there are other people now doing research in this area too. Every time I would publish a study and I would read someone else's work, they would always say, well, the evidence is mixed. Some studies find that religion is important and reduces crime, but other studies don't find the effect. So it's a mixed bag. So I kept hearing this from, you know, other authors, other scholars. So I reviewed every study that's been published on this topic from 1944 to 2010, 273 studies, and I didn't just read them. We coded these studies. What were their samples? What kind of methodology did they use? What were their conclusions? And of the 273 studies, 90% of these studies found an inverse effect, meaning that as religion, however it's measured, and we can talk about that in a minute, as religion, religiosity, religious commitment goes up, the likelihood of delinquency or crime or some deviant behavior goes down. That's what we found in 90% of the studies. And then the other 10%, we basically found that there people find no difference. There's no effect that stands out. Only a couple of studies found that there might be some kind of, quote, harmful effect of religion. But those studies tended to have weaker methodology. So here you have this astounding finding that religion matters in statistically significant ways in that many studies. But yet everyone would seem to say the evidence is mixed. It's anything but mixed. And so today, if you were standing in my office looking at my bookshelf, you would see all these books on criminology and criminal justice, these textbooks. You pull them off the shelf, you take the index, and you look through them, and you'll see the word religion not included in these textbooks anywhere. And it's kind of like, okay, so we've got this literature. These are empirical studies published in referee journals, but there's no citations in any of the textbooks. These are what professors use to teach students. Nothing about the influence of religion. And it goes back to how we started the broadcast when we were talking about this hostility, this resistance to all things faith-related. And what you find in the academy are scholars that are typically not very religious. And because they're not, for some of them, it's never dawned on them that faith would be meaningful. They've not, for whatever reason, noticed this emerging literature now that's a compelling body of evidence. Or worse, they've noticed it and they completely ignore it. So if you're a student and you want to major in criminal justice and you go to state, university, whatever, you're not going to hear about the importance of religion in any of your classes because it's just not in the textbooks.
Well, and you do address, though, that there are some faith-based programs that have sort of hurt themselves or maybe hurt the cause by not submitting to the proper testing. Talk a little bit about sort of those exceptions to the rule.
You know, I try not to let anyone get away with anything in this book. So while I take these people that are secular and hostile to religion to task for that, I also take these faith-based groups who've said to me over the years, we don't need research. We don't need people like you to come in here to tell us what we do matters. We know what we do matters, and we know what we do is effective. And I've had some even to tell me that their programs are 100% effective. And it's kind of like, well, first of all, there are no programs that are 100% effective. They don't exist. And if you say that your program's 100% effective, right off the bat, you're going to lose any credibility with anyone that hears about it because they know that's not true. And so I've had a very difficult time working with faith-based groups over the years that didn't feel they needed research at all. And, you know, my response to that is, you know, if we're going to be good stewards of God's time, then we need to be able to say, you know, evaluate us. Make sure what we're doing is working. If it's not, let's figure out what the problem is. Let's get it fixed. Let's be effective as we can be because we should be called to do the best we can possibly do. So there have been people within the faith community that have been completely suspicious of any and all forms of research. And I think it's time that they say, you know what, those days are over. We could use some assessment to see if we're going down the right path or how we can maybe improve on what we're doing.
It does seem, though, with the, I mean, as you said, 90%+ having a positive impact, is the only way to get the message out is to write books? I mean, is it the issue that we're just not communicating, getting the message through?
I think that's it. And I think what happens is when people like me write empirical journal articles in referee journals, the reality is it's only a handful of academic scholars that read that stuff. We haven't done a good job as scholars of making our work accessible to everyday people. And that's why, actually, I did this book. I did it for everyday people in the pews. And it's a way to say, look, what you're doing matters. It matters in some profoundly important ways. There's so much more we could do together if we would all come together to work in these unique partnerships. And so this is my first real major effort to do something that could be disseminated widely. And so far, the response has been pretty overwhelming.
Well, I mean, those of us that have a faith perspective aren't surprised by the findings. But you do provide a few examples, and just take a few minutes to talk about some of that you review in the book. Once again, I mean, it maybe just reaffirms that, whether it's the IFI program, whatever it is, I mean, there are some positive differences.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was to take the reader. And, you know, it's one thing to say we have all these studies, but it's another thing to look at some particular programs. And so I focused on a couple that I thought readers might really enjoy. And one's the story of the Boston Miracle. And this goes back to 1990 when there was just a youth violence run amok in Boston, about 150 homicides in 1990, and gang violence was a concern that everybody had. The law enforcement community could not get a handle on it. The faith community was concerned, especially inner-city black churches that were right in these same neighborhoods, and it kind of culminated when a young teenager was killed, and at his funeral, a gang burst into the church, started shooting guns, and that's what got the people to say, that's enough, we're going to respond. And so a group of black churches in inner city Boston said, let's band together and let's work with the police on this. So they did. They met with the police officials, they met with the probation officials and the courts, and they teamed up to address youth violence. And, they got some of the more serious offenders off of the streets, and the pastors helped get them off the streets. But then at the same time, the pastors said, look, some of these kids, we can help them. and give us a chance with them. And the law enforcement community said, we'll do it. That drove the youth homicide rate down to zero. They went like 18 months without any deaths whatsoever. And it showed what a few congregations, if they were intentional, what they could do. And that, and some of the ministers that were involved in that wound up on, you know, like the cover of Newsweek. It became a national story, and people were flocking to Boston to see how they pulled off this miracle. And I think what it showed was that when we come together, police were scratching their head, pastors were scratching their head, but when they came together, they were able to do something pretty powerful, and they both acknowledged the other's involvement in that solution. So that's one story that I talk about. And then there's one where the Amachi story, which is mentoring children of prisoners. This is a group that's kind of been neglected over the years. We talk a lot about prisoners, but we don't talk about the fact that these prisoners have kids. And these kids are at high risk for themselves growing up and winding up in prison. And this movement was launched in 2000 to provide a mentor for kids who have a parent incarcerated. And it was a project that brought together secular and religious groups, congregations in Philadelphia with Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America. And in the course of 1 year, they doubled the size of the number of matches made in Philadelphia. Now it's all across the country. In a decade, over 100,000 matches have been made. And the thing, Neil, that's so important about that story is not just that kids got a mentor, a caring adult in their life from a congregation, but think about the lives that could be changed through that one mentor who invested in the kid and completely changed the trajectory of that kid's life. It's an important thing, and it shows that churches are volunteer-rich organizations that can help change the way we think about some of these problems and help us achieve scale on what are really difficult issues.
You know, it's interesting, just as you've shared those illustrations, the importance of collaboration that, you know, even if we're faith-based, even if we run into resistance, there really is a place for collaboration, isn't it?
Well, you know what happens when people of faith collaborate with people of no faith? It breaks down the barriers, and some of the myths that people have are shattered. And, you know, I remember when I went to graduate school and I was working on a PhD, my advisor was Jewish, but he was secular. He wasn't a particular person of faith at all. And he was from New York and I was from the South. And I literally busted every stereotype he had of what it meant, what he thought it meant to be a evangelical Christian from the South. And to me, it was fascinating that he had these kinds of stereotypes. But I think once we got to know each other, we became very close friends, and his views changed substantially. And I think this is how people of faith offer so much. And so that's why I think the partnerships are so critical to helping us make headway in achieving, you know, solutions to really difficult social problems.
The book we're referencing today is called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And my guest is Byron Johnson, who's Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at the Baylor University. He directs the Institute for Studies of Religion, as well as directing the program on pro-social behavior at Baylor, and has a number of other significant credits to his name, and we're thankful that he had some time to join us today. The book is just out. More God, Less Crime. And in a moment, we want to talk about how people of faith can be involved and where we can do the most good and make the differences that are actually taking place already, and just with more help could make a big difference. It could matter more. We'll talk about it in a minute here on Connecting Faith. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. It's 877-933-2484. Seven past the hour, and we're called to be God's hands and feet, his representatives. And one of the things that we're specifically talking about is to care for those in prison. The fact is that more and more, it seems, are being incarcerated all the time. It's a huge, expensive proposition, and What are some solutions? Well, we're addressing them today. More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More is the title of a new book from Byron Johnson, who's professor at Baylor University and heads their Institute for Studies of Religion. Byron, let's talk about men and women of faith that could advocate for or be involved in the system. Where can we make the most difference and do the most good?
Well, you know, I think it's really important to say that this is not only important work, it's difficult work. And I wouldn't want Neil to make the mistake to say that everyone's called to do this kind of work. Almost certainly that's not the case. But there probably are a good number of people that are called. And I think one of the things that we do in churches is sometimes we figure out, you know, can you do nursery duty? Can you teach a Sunday school class? Could you be an usher? Blah, blah, blah. But we haven't thought like this. Are you an attorney? Are you an accountant? Do you own a business? Might you be able to use those skills to help an offender be reintegrated back into society? This is not the conventional kind of an ask that you would see in a congregation. And I think these represent just some of the ways in which people could use their own talents and gifts that God's given them to help people in the real world. And what the inmates call the free world, where you and I live, that's the free world. And you know, it's wonderful to do prison ministry. It's important to do it. But, boy, if one can connect and mentor a person both in prison and stick with them when they're out of prison, that's what I found to be the difference in the Interchange Freedom Initiative program, this faith-based prison that's now spreading in a number of states. It was the role of a mentor that stuck with an inmate once they got out of prison and helped them through that difficult transition back into society. And they have so many hurdles to overcome. This is where a person of faith and a congregation can be so important. And so they need that support network. I think people like you and me grew up with support networks, but there are plenty of people that didn't have a support network. Maybe the only support network they had, unfortunately, was a negative one, and it was a gang. But that's why, by the way, we have you keep mentioning the Center for Pro-Social Behavior. What that means is, why is it that people do the right thing? Why do people make the right choices in life? We know why they make bad choices. And what we're finding is that faith is central to helping people make good decisions, pro-social decisions, decisions that are other-minded. And that's part of the equation that sometimes people overlook. We're drawn to look at the negative, and I think we need to look at the positive. You know, why do people respond to disaster relief, and why do people help their brothers in need? These are all pro-social things. So one of the things I was going to say, that if your viewers are listening to this and they feel like they're called to help, Prison Fellowship has just launched a new ministry called Out for Life. And this is where they're intentionally seeking faith-motivated individuals to help them work with offenders post-release in the community, from jobs to mentoring to counseling to GED skills, et cetera. Life skills, balancing a checkbook, getting a driver's license. These are difficult things for former inmates, and these are things that I think that people in churches across the country can help with. And I wanted to say there's a resource that I'm working on right now, and there's a website out there too that we just released called moregodlesscrime.com. And there's a video that will be going up in the next few days, as well as all kinds of other materials that people can get for free and download. It also shows them how they can get the book if they want to do that. But I'm actually writing kind of a how-to manual that hopefully within the next few weeks will be up online that people could get. They would actually have contact information for folks in their communities where they live that they could get into contact with if they really want to be involved.
MoreGodLessCrime.com is the website. I want to give you an opportunity to offer some concluding comments about what the implications are if religion continues to be ignored in the criminal justice system. But we do have a call from Ellen we want to take, listening to Faith 1200 in Fargo. Ellen, go ahead. You're on with Byron Johnson.
Hi. I'm wondering if you've given any thought to perhaps having a faith-based parole agent once they get out that could connect them with churches, mentors, you
know,
maybe do groups or something like that with the faith-based offenders from that prison that
sure.
keep them connected.
Okay, well, good question. Yeah.
Ellen, that's a fantastic point. And, you know, many years ago when I just graduated from college and I was getting ready to start graduate school, I actually was a parole officer. And, you know, I didn't know anything. I'm just 21 years old. They introduced me to a file cabinet with files on over 120 offenders, some of them parole, some of them on probation, and they said, manage that caseload. And it was, you know, on-the-job training. I was overwhelmed. And as I look back on that experience, I did that for 1 year in graduate school. If someone had said to me, you know, you don't know me, Byron, but I want to volunteer. I actually do this other job, but I've got some time I can give to you. I'm a faith-based person, you know. It drives me, but I feel like I'm supposed to be helping. Could I volunteer? Could I be of any service to you as a parole officer? I would have said, absolutely. I've got this guy that I can't seem to get through to, but I would love to help this kid because if I don't, he's going to wind up in prison. And but I don't have enough time because I haven't even seen these other guys on my caseload. I, you know, there's just too much to do here. So I think even in fields like probation and parole, we could be doing so much more and being of real service to people that are already overworked and don't have the wherewithal to spend with offenders. But and the IFI program that we alluded to, the faith-based prison program, actually did that. They had people in the field that were working with parole, and parole really loved it because it helped them be able to do their jobs more effectively, and they could ask the people in the faith community for feedback on how to work with certain offenders such that we did a better job of keeping them from going back to prison.
You know, Byron, our time is getting by quickly here. I just want to give you a chance to talk about maybe the implications of you know, if it's less God, does that equal more crime? What are the implications of religion continuing to be ignored in this area?
Well, it's devastating. You know, I don't want to be one of these people that tries to create a panic, but we are at a time unprecedented in our country of financial shortfalls where states left and right are making drastic cuts in their budgets because they're in such financial straits. And the criminal justice system in the past has never really been hit hard, but now they are. They're cutting drastically in prisons. And so what happens is these problems that we already have are going to be more pronounced as these cutbacks take place. And so what I'm seeing is a unique window for people of faith to respond, and I'm seeing a unique willingness from governmental leaders and authorities to say, we welcome any kind of partnership that can help us with these problems that are so significant. So I think, you know, if we could end on a bright note, that is that there's a window of opportunity that is I haven't seen before that encourages me that because our problems are so significant, that people of faith won't be as marginalized as they have been in the past. And hopefully, God willing, we can make a real step forward.
And as you've seen firsthand and studied about it, there is real life change taking place through these faith-based programs, right?
That's so true. I mean, it really is true. And, you know, I don't say that faith solves everything in the book. I try to be very careful to say that it's a huge component. It's a foundational component. But, boy, we can build so much in and around that truly is transformative and long-lasting, and that's what we need. We don't need little fixes. We need sustainable solutions that we can go to scale with.
We've got some great research to build on, thanks to Byron Johnson, professor of social sciences at Baylor University, and he directs the Institute for Studies of Religion, and he's put together some great research in his new book called More God, Less Crime. More God, Less Crime. The subtitle is Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And Byron, again, you mentioned the website. More information coming up on there all the time, right?
Yeah, so. moregodlesscrime.com is the website where people can find out more. And it's been great to be with you, Neil.
Good. Thanks so much, Byron Johnson, with us today from Baylor University. By the way, speaking of crime, tomorrow we'll spend a little time with the Long Island Don. That was his name before the feds caught up with him. And thanks to some intervention there and his wife's prayers, he's become a follower of Christ. And Michael Franzese tells his story in the book Blood Covenant, and he will talk to us tomorrow. We'll talk about his passion and his ministry and his story. That's on tomorrow's edition of Connecting Faith, and I encourage you to join us right here on Faith Radio, helping you connect faith to life every day. And remember, again, the website, if you're looking for more information from Byron Johnson, it's More God, Less Crime. But we always put links up on our website as well. It's the Connecting Faith page at faithradionet.com. So go to faithradionet.com and click on the Connecting Faith page, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.